If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Does an algorithm always decide what I see online?
How biased are my search results?
Is plugging generative AI into search a good idea?
This is For Tech's Sake, a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. We're your hosts, Jenny Darmody
and Elaine Burke. And today, Jenny, we're going to talk about algorithms of influence. So they're in your search results, they're in your recommendations engines, they're in your personalization systems. They're all over the shop.
Yeah.
Online, anyway. Do you yourself ever think about how much an algorithm is deciding what you see online?
I do. Mostly though, because I have to think about it, because as a journalist, as an editor, I have to be aware of, you know, what's curating my search and things like that. Now, I say I think about it. I'm aware of it and I know that it's happening. So when I search something and I see something come up to the top and it's a good thing that I want to see at the top, I'm like, ah, and I'm like, oh, it's probably because I'm being served this, because it knows. So I think about the fact that algorithms know an awful lot about me. And particularly if I go into not just Google, but other social media platforms and things like that, like I know what's getting served up to me is very much curated for me and what I have searched before. So I do think about that often. Don't do anything about it. I think about it.
Do you, like, as in you don't do anything about it? Like you were like clicking yes to like use my data?
No, I do. I do. No, that's not true. Actually, I'm very cavalier about that. I do restrict things like that. Now, sometimes it can get me on a low ebb and I just click the thing that's the fastest thing. But I don't. Mostly I do not tell it to use my data. But still, it doesn't. I feel like it's already got
enough.
So much data that it, like, I don't know if clicking no matters that much anymore. Yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing. I kind of feel like they're suffering from a preponderance of data and they don't really know how to use it. Like every company in the world right now. Because, like, it's one thing, like, when you're in search and you put in an actual query that you want a request for, but how that's used after the fact for the recommendations engines, that kind of grinds my gears sometimes. Like, I do TV reviews on the radio, so I have to search sometimes about the shows that I want to write about, but I'm also watching those shows and I don't want spoilers for them.
Oh yeah.
And discovery engines like Google's recommendations of like stories and like your mobile homepage and stuff like that, I have to be tread so carefully into them now, because like when I was watching Succession and trying not to get spoiled in Succession but know things about what was happening in Succession, I mean, this is, the writers are in trouble here, or the headline writers at least, for the things that they put into headlines and the pictures that they put next to the things that they put into headlines, because all that's showing up in my recommendations engines and it was ruining my day.
I was fascinated about the YouTube recommendation engine in particular when there was the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial, the defamation case, because I did not look at that at all. I actively avoided it. I didn't search it. I didn't want to know what was happening. I didn't care. I'm an active user on YouTube and my YouTube is crap. Like I am unashamed about this. This is what some people may call a guilty pleasure. I do not believe in guilty pleasures, but I am a big fan of react videos. That is what I watch. Things that I have seen before, I want to see other people react to. I just can't help myself. So that, like, that's what my algorithm is flooded with. They're like, you like this? More of this, please.
Yeah, more of the
same.
It's
very accurate. Yeah. And clips of shows that I watch now that they're safely spoiler free. If I've already passed them or whatever and things like that. So like my YouTube algorithm is, I would consider it quite accurate by and large, except when that trial was on, I was flooded with stuff and I didn't watch any of them. But I was like, why do I keep getting shown this stuff? Constant clips, and not even just like, you know, Reuters is you know, reporting on it. It was like memes and like compilation clips, and interestingly, all very pro Johnny Depp, which I think was a particularly important part of why that was being served up. It was very much, it felt calculated. It felt like someone or a team or something was like cleverly manipulating an algorithm system to make sure that this was getting served up quite powerfully en masse.
Yeah. And like, there's conspiracy theories that there was PR teams and stuff like that involved. But like, I mean, whatever you think about that, you don't actually even need a actual agency involved in this, because we have seen countless times how fandoms, online fandoms, are excellent at manipulating things online, because they know all the trickeries and they come in numbers, and that's all it takes, is knowledge of how a system works and numbers. And sometimes your numbers don't even have to be real people, because you can create bots as well. And that's the whole thing. Like, the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial was a really interesting case study in that kind of manipulation of content online, because the problem with like trending factors and stuff like that, so say you see like every day during that trial, that was what was trending on Twitter, was Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. And it was like, I didn't know many people in my life who wanted to talk about it. Like, it
were
was
invested
a,
in this.
Like, and that's the thing. Like, it was just a really vicious trial, and it was very public, very harrowing, I'm sure, for people to have to listen to some of the descriptions of abuse from both sides and everything. And it, like, a lot of people just kind of didn't want to engage with it. I'm like, sure, it was troubling for a lot of people that it was so front and center for a lot of news agencies. Now, news agencies will cover it because it gets clicks. So that's a whole problem in and of itself, in terms of like how content is being manipulated itself, like content creators themselves being manipulated to serve an algorithm and not to actually serve people's best interests. But the bot situation is a whole other thing. And on the Twitter trends for the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial, there was a report from Bot Sentinel that analysed 14,292 tweets that included anti-Amber Heard hashtags. Because that's the thing, like, you create hashtags and then you're more likely to create these trends on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, if you have accounts retweeting them and resharing the stuff.
Yeah, Justice for Johnny, I think, was like one of the key like pro-Depp ones.
So like, of the over 14,000 tweets, they kind of singled out 627 accounts dedicated to tweeting negatively about Amber Heard and her female supporters. So if you were, and it really was focused on women, if you were a woman who came out in support of Amber Heard on the side of that trial, you were more likely to get the dogpiling.
Targeted,
like, and it's just like, it, the women thing is a whole other aspect of this. So like, nearly a quarter of those accounts, the 627 accounts, so 24.4%, had been created in the past 7 months.
Yeah.
So it just seemed a bit like those accounts were nearly created to fire up this media storm around this story. Like, it's just really, really sus. Now, the report is from Bot Sentinel. Bot Sentinel does do research on bots, but they weren't looking at bots in this case. So it's not saying that these accounts were bots. They could have been people from a fandom.
Yeah.
Like, equally, like, there's big numbers in fandoms. And also, disclaimer, Bot Sentinel were hired by Heard's legal team to determine social media activity against her, whether it was organic or that. Now, that was a separate report to this report, but that's just a disclosure there to say that that's a thing. Don't at me about this story. I don't care what your opinion is. But it's just like, Bot Sentinel does a lot of work in this space, kind of analysing the kind of trends on Twitter and stuff like that. And, you know, what they said in their report was similar campaigns were waged against Meghan Markle, Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And what did those two women have in common with Amber Heard? They're women.
Yeah.
And like I said, it was women who came out in support of Amber Heard that got piled on in this. So like, that was a whole gross thing that was happening. And it was, what it was a manipulation of recommendations engines, because none of that stuff would have gotten air if not for the fact that it looked like it was trending on Twitter all day.
Yeah.
Possibly artificially inflated by either a fandom with an agenda or bots. Either one is bad.
Yeah. And the thing is, once it gets, it just needs to get inflated enough for actual people who are going about their day, who don't think they're interested in this, but like, you know, there's definitely psychology around being served up something repeatedly and eventually just clicking on it out of interest. Like, that's going to happen. And then it's getting organically inflated because other people are doing it, and it's just a big avalanche.
And then it absolutely snowballs and it spirals out of control, because you get like, the media keeps reporting on it, saying like, oh, well, people on Twitter are talking about this. So if I report on it, I'll trend on Twitter. I just think, when we think of this stuff and how easy it can be manipulated.
Yeah.
And how easily, like, we're at a phase now where people know how algorithms work. Content creators understand what are the, like, points I need to hit.
Yeah.
To make sure that my content gets big and I look like I have the triumphant voice in this debate or whatever. So with that in mind, what does that mean for us as consumers of the media?
Well, this is a concern I have, because and particularly again with the Heard and Depp trial as well, because YouTube and other social media platforms in general is where more news is getting consumed, more news is getting like found, particularly by the younger generation. There was actually a report on this on Silicon Republic. It's not our report. Yeah. It's from the Reuters Institute of Journalism. But we reported on it, and it was particularly interesting because social media, particularly in Ireland, is on the rise for how, you know, younger people consume news in general and things like that. And even there was an interesting thing where it said nearly half of those surveyed either strongly agree or tend to agree that they can trust news most of the time, but it has fallen slightly. But they're also more likely to trust, they're happy for algorithms to create their news more than actual journalists. Which is really concerning. They seem to know that that's problematic. They seem to know that algorithms are in a way manipulated, but they're happy for it to happen. They're happy for that. They're happy for algorithms to choose their news rather than,
again, brain scramblies, because it's like it's kind of like this. The survey is nearly the same for both of those responses.
Yeah.
It was like more people felt it's better for algorithms to be your curator of news. I would disagree, but I'm clearly biased in that respect. I am a journalist and editor, and I think we do a really good job at curating news. But fair enough, I'm open to argument on that and why an algorithm is better at that job. But it was just the nature of so many people saying that, and then more than half of the people surveyed also saying it could cause them to miss important news stories or only encounter the viewpoints that are similar to their own, i.e. an echo chamber, which is what algorithms kind of do create, I think. And I just feel like if you like go to an algorithm for that, well, like there's an element that I feel like algorithms are not, you know, they're not about serving your best interests, which, you know, a publication that you have shared values with is about. And algorithms, I actually think, serve your worst interests in a lot of ways, because, you know, a lot of our behaviors aren't good for us. You know, we all have those problems. And say if you were searching stuff that's not good for you, like, and I can go to an extreme with this, like, you know, people can use online searches to search for self-harm content. And if there aren't safeguards in place, now some systems do have safeguards in place for that to offer help if someone's making those searches. But if there aren't those safeguards in place and an algorithm is just being like, well, more of that then, because that's what you're into. Like, even if you find yourself getting out of a dangerous space, well, you could probably be dragged back into it by something that's constantly about serving you the worst of your desires, because that's what that is programmed into it along with the other stuff that you do. And we're not, you know, we're not good at resisting temptation for bad things. Like, that's why we eat so much ice cream and drink so much beer. Like, it's delicious. I have this huge concern about, we think of algorithms as arbitrary, but well, that means that it also has no values.
Yeah.
No value system, no morals or anything like that. They'll never be able to be coded into it. And that means like your worst behaviors can also be amplified by this stuff.
Yeah. And it's also interesting when you mentioned about like searching for things and stuff, because humans are biased on their own anyway. So, you know, when you talk about search and algorithms, people may put in as neutral a search as they can, or they may put in a biased search. You know, a great one that people love attacking is just like, why is a vegan diet bad? That's a biased search. And you're going to get served up loads of reasons from God knows what sources to explain to you why you're right about that phrase, even though that's not actually an unbiased search. And I am not a vegan, but like people do come at vegans like mad. People get very mad when they talk about like taking meat out of your diet. It's the same as climate deniers. It's the same as lots of other of that side of the house of things. Like people do be getting mad about that stuff. So if you put in biased searches, are you starting to just inform your own bias further? And that's again where algorithms are a problem, because they are not unbiased if you're telling them what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit like, you know, the purveyors of confirmation bias.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm so glad you brought up search, because search is really important. It's how most of us interact with online environments as a first port of call.
And look for information.
100%. So let's bring in our expert. Today, we are speaking to Professor Gareth Jones, an internationally recognized researcher based at the ADAPT Centre in Dublin City University. And his research focuses on information retrieval and search technologies. Perfect for this discussion. And he recently won one of the DCU President's Awards for research for his work on information retrieval from digital archives for a better informed society. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Gareth, and being an expert in information retrieval. Like, essentially, that's search. That's our online searches is what you research.
Yes, that's the fundamental science behind things that I guess people would most conventionally or most popularly see as sort of search engines, sort of Google and some of the less well-known things like Bing. So, you know, how do you find information in the world today? It's kind of the underlying technologies of that.
And definitely, like, is that's probably the first port of call for most people doing something on the internet, is to go to a search engine.
Yeah, so search actually has a very long history. It first came sort of in library science in the 1950s, and, you know, people just wouldn't really have heard of it then. And then with the emergence of the internet sort of 30-odd years ago, suddenly this sort of technology, which is a very specialist librarian thing, has become a technology for everybody, and it's become sort of an indispensable tool of daily life to be able to search for things for most people, yeah.
And it's actually because of the like advancement that has been done in search. Many of us probably don't appreciate, but like in those old versions of computer searches, you would have had to know certain ways to frame a search, like Boolean logic and stuff like that to put into it. And we don't need to do that anymore.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So people were trained in how to use them. And in fact, sort of librarians and some specialist users of search tools like patent examiners and things would still actually use that kind of thing because it gives them a lot of control. But the so one of the challenges in research really was to make tools that are easy enough to use. People just put in a few words into their little box at the front of the Google web page, and Google magically finds what you want to know.
And it finds a lot. Like, I mean, the pages and pages and pages.
And so there are literally billions of pages out there. And, you know, when people are talking about information retrieval, it's really a needle in the haystack problem. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's absolutely true that, you know, you're just trying to find that one or two or three documents which are really going to, or items which are going to tell you what you want to know out of billions that are out there. So it's a massively, it's an amazing thing to be able to do that. And it really does rely on taking as much information about you and other people as possible to try and to sort of hone down and sort of find the things that you might be interested in.
And that's where the algorithm comes in. So like our search results are, you know, comparing your query next to a massive database of the internet, but also filtering the results through an algorithm that kind of gives you like maybe the best results based on like how often they're visited or?
Well, in fact, there's a whole sort of soup of different things. So different search engine companies they call them signals, and they're sort of merging these together to sort of try and give a score to each item to find you the things that you're most interested in. So back in the old days when collections were small, you know, in the orders of thousands or hundreds of thousands of documents, they would just compare the contents of the query to the contents of the document and that would work. But doesn't work on a big scale. You know, if I've got a three-word query and I've got billions of documents, I'm going to have thousands or hundreds of thousands of documents which match that little query. So I need to use other signals to find you that top 10. People don't like going beyond 10 answers and maybe even beyond 5. So you've got to try and push into that top 5 things that people are going to find interesting. And so would you like to learn more about the signals?
Yeah.
Okay. So when Google appeared, and so people will have kind of may have heard of a thing called PageRank or using the structure of the web. So they use things like the popularity of a page. So how many people point at your web page? And there's a sort of community effect there that if lots of people like your web page, other people will like it too. So they would harvest and see how many pages point to your page. And you don't know how many pages point to that because they look at all of the web or they look at a large portion of the web. They can see how many pages have got a link in them pointing to your web page. And so they can favor pages which lots of people are looking at or lots of people are pointing at because they're likely to be authoritative or they're likely to be interesting because lots of people are conferring that they like it and that it's good stuff, that it's important.
And that's how those pages get to like the top of that rank.
Well, that's one of the signals. Yeah. Yeah. And so another very important signal is what they refer to as click through. So, you know, when you get your list, you need to type your query in, back come your list of documents, and you click. And so they will take a correspondence between your query and the click. And so many queries are very popular. Lots of people, you know, will be looking for the same topic or the same person or the same place or whatever, or the same event. And so which items are they all clicking on? And so they'll keep a log of that. So when I enter a query that maybe 10, 100, 1,000 people have put in before, they'll have a notion, they'll know which pages they clicked on. And so again, for me, they'll favor not just the pages which match and not just the pages that are popular in terms of who's pointing to them, but also which pages did other people click on, because they're most likely to be the ones I'm interested in as well.
And does the account you use, for example, kind of affect those kind of recommendation systems? Because a lot of people use their Gmail account, for example, to log in to these systems like YouTube and stuff. Is a separate company, but you're logging in with your Gmail account. It's hooked up to your Gmail account, which is connected to your Google account, and you're logged into Gmail all the time. Does that have any impact, or do they admit that?
I have to say, I'm not sure exactly which service, which information is shared between different services like that. I mean, they've obviously acquired different companies at different times, and I think there were various promises made in terms of, you know, silo effects or sort of, you know, keeping these things separate. But, you know, lots of people report sort of bizarre effects that, you know, they were looking at something and then suddenly they're being recommended a product. So there is something going on in the background. But then on the other hand, sometimes it's just like, you were thinking about this because it's in the news. It's in the news. That's why it's being recommended to you. So it's not clear how much of it is due to sort of sharing information and how much is just sort of social coincidence of what's going on.
I wonder, do you get asked this as often as we do? I mean, one of the primary things I get asked when I tell people I'm a tech journalist is my phone listening to me because I speak about this thing and then I get an ad for it. But like, with all your knowledge of those information systems and how they can connect the dots, my theory has been that that's how they're doing it. It's that maybe some other signal that you gave to the system.
Well, that's probably it. Yeah. So part of it can be some other signal you gave to the system. So, you know, you clicked on something because it was recommended to you, or you put in a query. It doesn't necessarily have to be listening to you all the time. You're just giving enough evidence. Sometimes it's just coincidence. You know, things can just happen, you know. So, you know, what I don't know, once a month, something slightly strange like that might happen. But the amount of information that's served up to me all the time, perhaps that just happens by chance. Other times, you know, I happen to be in a location, I'm thinking about something, the location makes it relevant to me, so if they give me some product. Sometimes it's a temporal thing, it's a time thing, you know, it's in the news, or it's something that's seasonal or something. So, you know, I don't know to what extent this is going on. I mean, people were worried about sort of things like smart speaker systems, sort of, you know, sitting in your home, your Alexa system or one of the others, that's your Apple system that's sitting there. And so they, you know, there've been various studies of, you know, what's actually going on. And as far as I understood from the surveys, you know, that it only listens when it's supposed to be listening. I mean, if it was doing recognition all the time, it would be costing them money. You know, they're pumping data back into their servers. They're running their speech recognition system. I mean, have they got the resource to all of the users to do that all the time? Probably not. Do they want to invest the money in doing that all the time? Probably not. So, you know, I think you can get a bit paranoid.
Yeah. I think there's an element of confirmation bias to it that you've kind of triggered for me there, where like, we remember the ones that were spooky, but we don't remember the many, many recommendations
we get all day that were wrong.
And then that makes me think kind of on the next question, like, what do you think about the idea of maybe bias in search? Like, because algorithms can have bias in them as well. Maybe the signals that we put in for personalization and stuff like that might create bias. Like, is that something that you have to address in your work?
So bias, I think, has become a more concerning element. You know, people, I think, were for most of the history of sort of trying to make such algorithms better concerned with what we might refer to as relevance or interestingness. You know, is this actually interesting? And then we kind of say, well, what kind of content is being served up? Is it always from the same sort of source, and does that matter? And so they have these effects where you sort of you'd be looking at a particular view of the world because it matches very well with what you're doing. So you'll get a sort of biased, I don't know, political view of the world or environmental view of the world because it's a sort of echo chamber confirmation bias type things. And so to what extent should you be pulling away from that and making sure people get a range of different things? Because the simple algorithm possibly does sort of give you that sort of view and you feel happy with it because it's what you're familiar with. And but, you know, is that actually a good thing to be doing? Should you be giving people a much more varied set of results?
This is how it's always been.
Double Love is a podcast in which we explore the strange and terrifying world of Sweet Valley High, book by book. Join me, Anna Carey.
And me, Karen Moynihan.
As we revisit one of the maddest series of books ever written, or ghostwritten.
If you ever read about Elizabeth and Jessica, the perfect blonde Wakefield twins, then you might enjoy listening to us absolutely tearing them to shreds. Affectionately, of course.
Of course. And even if you didn't, there's still plenty of drama, kidnapping, stolen boyfriends and school dances to entertain you.
Find us on the Headstuff Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot about the text and the words on the page and that kind of thing, and it does seem to still primarily be focused on text-based internet, but a lot of the work that you do is looking at maybe some sort of voice search, like with audio and multimedia searches and stuff like that. So what is the kind of next evolution for search in those terms?
So yes, you're right. So a lot of search is still based on text. So in fact, so taking YouTube again as an example, I mean, other video channels are available. But you know, if you put queries in, a lot of it is based on the what we refer to as metadata, the words that describe the content rather than the content itself. I guess because it sort of builds naturally on all the existing text things. But the content of it, what's inside it, is really important. So we're making a podcast now. A podcast, you know, typically half an hour in length. There's thousands of podcasts out there. So how do you find the podcast? Well, conventional way would be to sort of use the metadata. So who was talking? What were they talking about? You know, what was the name of the series or whatever? But within individual podcasts, people will talk about different things. And so you may not want to listen to a whole half-hour podcast. You might want to listen to a small part of it. That might be the bit that's really interesting for you. So rather than being given a small number of full-length podcasts, you could be given a larger number of pieces of podcasts with what we might think of as sort of a jump-in point. So start listening at minute 17 or something, because that's going to be what you're about. And so a lot of my work on voice search would look at that. So we're interested in spoken content, but we're transcribing the content and then we're looking at the progression of the discussion of the and then sort of trying to sort of come up with methods to sensibly suggest points to start listening. Now, you don't want to start listening at the point where the word in the query appeared because it doesn't make sense. So you have to sort of go back topically to where they started talking about it. And it's those sort of scientific challenges that kind of, you know, try to enable that and also then allow people to maybe adjust a little bit if it hasn't quite started in the right place. So some sort of interface to let people
That's interesting. And I know you're doing some work with Spotify. So is that to do with that? I don't know how much you can tell us.
It was a benchmark task. So which means that we basically... Spotify, benchmark tasks in general, people release a set of data. And so Spotify had a set of data they were happy to release to the research community. And, you know, people had to sort of sign they weren't going to do anything commercial with it, but they released it. And then we released a task. So it's exactly that kind of task. So here are some queries, find within the Spotify archive parts of podcasts which sort of match what people are interested in. That was why Spotify were interested. They were interested in, you know, being able to search that. But I've had my students have worked on other tasks, sort of searching data from meetings and things like that, searching data from lectures and things.
That's so interesting. And then if it was like to transpose kind of those techniques to video, you would rely on the audio and the speech?
Yeah, so traditionally, actually, yeah. So video search did rely an awful lot on audio to speech transcripts. Visual processing is very hard, or traditionally was very hard. So, you know, you start finding particular, you know, sort of find colours and shapes and things like that. And you can find people, and then you can try to find named people. You can find cars and, you know, various simple events where people started off with 20 years ago, they were doing research trying to do that. And the recent advances in AI have really sort of pushed things along a lot. So our video processing is getting a lot more powerful and you can do a lot more interesting things with that. So potentially you can find an event in a video. You know, people tend to sort of do research on movies and sports matches. Sports is good actually because it's so structured. So people would be, you know, looking at soccer in the US, they'd be sort of looking at baseball and things like that because there's lots of rules. You know, in soccer, you know, you'll see a defined set of possibilities. You know, someone scores goals, there's a foul, somebody gets sent off, you know, the substitution as a free kick, you know, so you can look to sort of, you know, you've got sort of like a set of rules of what's likely to happen. So you can build these different visual detectors to find these events. And so you can then build a sort of a structure of what happened in the match. And you say, I want the goals. So the system will find the goal event. So, you know, it finds the goals, it finds the ball going into the net. It may be, if it's a broadcast match, there'll be kind of the score will be displayed on the screen. So it finds the text on the screen. You know, so it's kind of quite a controlled environment. So from a research point of view, it's really been very valuable over the last sort of, I don't say 15 so years. Your home movies of your, you know, your kind of parties or events or family occasions or whatever, that much, they haven't got that same structure. They haven't got the editing. They probably haven't got the same visual quality. So, you know, but, you know, a lot of people record video material all the time, get their phone out and record something. Moment it just gets stored away and probably not looked at very much. And so if we could actually sort of access that content and enable you to find particular events and share them, then that's, you know, this content, which you just recorded because you could, actually becomes valuable. It becomes a sort of a good, a useful life resource to share with your family and friends.
That's so interesting about the sports thing, because I know when it came to AI for writing, things like sports matches and sport reporting on a sports match was one of the first good test cases that showed that it could do it. And it must be because it is such a structured thing that hadn't occurred to me. That's fascinating. And I cannot think what would happen if my partner figured out how to just be able to Google Keith Buckley goals against Shamrock Rovers and just I would lose him to the internet forever. It's fascinating.
And obviously search has evolved a lot more, especially recently. It's been in kind of major headlines because of the advances in natural language processing and, you know, Bing, which you said, like, you know, it was kind of the forgotten child compared to Google for a while, but it's had a bit of a resurgence because of ChatGPT and generative AI in general. What are your thoughts on that and how that's going to change search?
It's a really interesting question, and I think it's a kind of a hot question at the moment because it's not quite clear what direction it will take. So if you think about it, there's lots of sort of, often from answering questions or for search, there'll be a number of sources which will actually give you the information you want. So now a conventional thing, we type in a query, you get a list of documents, you choose number three, looks like it's going to be relevant and may have the answer in. But I mean, a ChatGPT service could get away from that phase, that it just generates an answer for you. So then it can generate a short paragraph explaining something for you. So this can be good because it means you haven't got to sort of engage with finding it within different. So, but it strikes me that, you know, there's potential for losing something there as well. You know, so in journalism, you know, I may like the writing of particular journalists. I may like to take news from different sources because they'll have different perspectives on it. So I'm not just looking. It's not just about facts. It's about interpretation and nuance. And, you know, so if you're just generating, you know, this is what happened at this particular place at this particular time, that's only one version. That's just factual. But, you know, different people might, you know, from their journalistic interpretation may pull in different factors. And you know, by reading different ones, you kind of get a broader picture. And you can make your own mind about what's important or what's going on somewhere. So I think whether that's important to people, I don't know. So whether they'll just be happy with just having a description or whether they'll want to sort of go back to the original sources, I don't know how that'll pan out.
And do you consider what that generative search is doing as information retrieval? Because it is different. It's not just giving you, pointing you in the direction of something that matches with your queries.
So like a textbook definition, information retrieval is satisfying an information need. So what people typically use a search engine because they have a need for information. It's literally. And so in a sense, I guess according to that definition, yeah, the ChatGPT thing is right. you know, it's, you know, it is doing information retrieval because it's satisfying your information need. But that's only like a simple factual need. If your need was really more nuanced and broader, would it really be satisfying your information need? And so it's, there's a little bit of a kind of how are we defining information retrieval? And maybe at different people in different environments and different settings, we'll perhaps need a different interface or a kind of a richer interface which allows them both the ChatGPT type response and the kind of linking to the original content in the way that we currently do, or possibly some combination where that content is brought together via some sort of chat-based service or something like that. And then, of course, there is the issue of sort of fake information. And so these chat services don't always tell you things as they really are, because it's based on lots of, you know, lots of observed data, lots of statistics, lots of learning, and so these things can make mistakes. And so there's I was reading something recently where facts were coming out of these things which it was impossible to verify. That's a little bit concerning, you know. So if I read something coming out of a system, I think, well, I'm not sure if that's true. I mean, I can go to a search engine right now and see if I can find an original source document which confirm it. But if it's sold in such a convincing way, and particularly concerning is if I'm not quite sure about something or I want to know a bit more about it, and I then can't find a source document, that's a little bit, but people just may come to believe things to be true which are not true. For whatever reason, which is a bit worrying.
Great to talk about an expert when it comes to search technologies and get all of his insights there. So thank you so much to Gareth. But I would say, I'm encouraged hearing from him about how search is developing. But when I go and use Google, I'm less encouraged because I do find that its value has diminished for me. I still use it all of the time, more than anything else. But yeah, I just don't find it as useful as it used to be.
Yeah, you're not convinced. You still think Google's a shit show.
It's just gone shit now. I do miss the days of good old Boolean search.
You're very excited. It was adorable.
Oh, because I did learn those techniques in a college class. That's how old I am, Jenny. We have gone through this before. And I was fascinated by it. So it's actually called Boolean search because it's named after George Boole. But essentially it was just putting in things that, again, were quite easy to understand. Like we talk about natural language processing for systems, but like this was easy to understand in terms of natural language because it just meant putting in symbols like a plus or a minus and using parentheses to kind of bracket out elements of a search term to like basically say, I want searches on this, but not with this term included, and maybe with this term, but I don't mind if it does or doesn't have that, but it absolutely has to have this one. So you could like be very pointed and specific about the results you wanted, didn't wanted, and how much variety you wanted in there. You can still use those techniques in some search engines. So there's ways to do Twitter advanced search. Actually, the Twitter advanced search form that you fill out is basically Boolean steps. It's great. So if you actually know how to write the Boolean logic, you don't need to use the form. You could actually just write one of those queries yourself, and I can do it because I'm a nerd. So I actually think I'm pretty good at search, and I know a few hacks for Google searches as well that I use often, and that's how I'm still getting good results out of Google. It's when I'm really specific about search queries and like use those little hacks and stuff like that. And I actually use the tools that Google has available to you where you can filter things out by like a timeline and filter out for just news based results and stuff like that. So like, to be fair, there are tools there to use it effectively, and I'm complaining about it because I'm lazy and I want to use it the old way when it was just good and you could just throw in a query and get what you wanted. But to come back to you and your skill set being skills gal, do you think we need to start like considering teaching search as a skill?
Yeah. Tell me your secret. I'm only kind of joking though, because if there's, you know, better ways to search, I mean, like that's not something that most people know, I think. And it's certainly not what the generation of today who are growing up, because Google is just, like you said, that's just like put in your question, you will get the answer. And even, do you know what's interesting actually? you know, we like there's a whole other area of how the, you know, the search engine is, you know, bleeding into the generative AI stuff. But how quickly since ChatGPT and all of those generative AI things have come out, have I been served up content on Instagram and LinkedIn of like, here is how to actually use that to your advantage. And it is that kind of mechanism to be like, don't just put in a query and it'll spit back out something that's like kind of good. Like, exactly this, not this, use this tone, pretend you're this, give me a 30-day plan to do this. Like, it's like there's skills even to use ChatGPT to make it not just be very like a bit shit, which, you know, we're in the early days of generative AI essentially, but there's already those kind of I suppose experts and things like that who are figuring out exactly how to get the crux of what you actually need out of ChatGPT and generative AI to say, this is the tone I want. Here's an example of something we did before. Do a bit of this, but make it less this. Like, there's ways to, you know, mechanically do that. And that comes back to that kind of Boolean search mechanism. And I think those search tips need to be trained for everything. I think there needs to be like a whole digital literacy area of skills that needs to be brought up. Like, I think that we take for granted that, you know, younger generations were born with all of this equipment and all of this technology already in the world and already like knows how to use it. But, you know, I almost feel like there was a learning curve that came with the equipment being born and adopted, that we all had to learn to use it. And now that it's just here, you forget that, you know, there's still skills that need to be learned. It's not just automatic that just because you show children a screen and they know how to swipe, there's still skills that need to be taught that are kind of going away, I think. I think learning how to search effectively, learning how to navigate the internet, knowing how to, you know, just use the internet as opposed to just, you know, I can log on to YouTube and find a video about cats because that's what I know how to do. And the user face has made that very easy to do. But there are ways to actually do it quite creatively and quite cleverly that are not being taught.
And that skill you're talking about with interacting with generative AI to get good results is being called prompt engineering. And it does really sound like prompt engineering is the new Boolean search. Mm. Yes, I'm bringing it back to Boolean search again. Three times in one episode we're getting a mention. But it's just like they're all kind of ways of interacting with these machines and systems that on the user side come with an understanding of how the system works. So that's the, I suppose we moved into an era where it's quite fluid and it's quite easy to interact with digital systems, and they do natural language processing and have, you know, nice interfaces that work most of the time and not all of the time, and can be very frustrating when they don't, because when they don't work, we have lost a bit of the understanding of how they work. So when you're using those more complex systems, you need an understanding of what you're interacting with, what it's going to interpret well, what it's going to misinterpret, what kind of guidance you need to give the system to get the good results. So yeah, definitely, I think that's an educational literacy gap we need to be considering for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, hire us to teach you things. We'd be really good at it. Thank you for listening to this episode of For Tech's Sake, and thank you to Professor Gareth Jones for sharing his expertise with us and with you. You can find out more about Gareth and his research at adaptcenter.ie, and we'll share some starter links in the show notes.
For Tech's Sake is a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. Follow us at Silicon Republic and at For Tech's Sake Pod on your platform of choice, and please subscribe and share and let us know what you think.
Next week, we'll have a bonus episode featuring the full uncut interview with Gareth for anyone who wants to know even more about search and how it works. This is exclusive for Headstuff Plus community members, so do look into signing up. Otherwise, we'll be back to you in a fortnight.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.